ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to keep pace with your world.
Because keeping up can be a challenge.
And events can feel overwhelming beyond our understanding.
What might Xi Jinping do next?
What hand is Trump hiding?
Join me, Hamish McDonald, Geraldine Doogue, Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Four voices bringing perspective, experience and energy to the big global stories.
Global roaming, weekdays at 11 on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen.
The first of Caltech's stars I interviewed way back was Linus Pauling. He had two Nobel Prizes, and so, yes, I wanted to ask him about peace and about the nature of the chemical bond. But no, all Pauling wanted to talk about was the wonders of vitamin C. The whole point about Caltech, you see, is its stars are so broad, you never know the limits of their mighty brains. Hello again, Robin Williams, with another science show from that tempestuous place called America, the Jekyll and Hyde continent. We're in Los Angeles, still recovering from fire, still brilliant, though torn. And our first example of that incredible breadth of interest is Professor François Tissot, who looks at star stuff and is called upon to investigate the threat of lead, not from guns, but from burned houses. And then he explains how unleaded petrol was conjured from this very Caltech campus. Why did you leave France?
I left after my undergraduate studies. I was offered a PhD position at the University of Chicago to do cosmochemistry.
Cosmochemistry, the chemistry of space?
Yes, trying to understand where the planets, our own solar system, but also all other planetary system, how do they come from, how do they form?
Well, maybe you can answer a couple of questions that have come up in recent science shows. One of them being from an asteroid which seems to contain a surprising number of organic molecules, you know, fairly elaborate molecules. And Mary Wojtek, the second example, who was on the science show last year, the head of the astrobiology for NASA, talking about how one of those complicated cycles in your body and mine now, and the listener's body now, in other words, Krebs cycle, some of those chemicals are also found in space bodies which land. What are they doing there?
This is a very good question. I think if we had the answer to this one already, we would be talking about Nobel Prize level discoveries. There's a richness to the complexity of molecules we find in asteroidal bodies. And one of the big questions for the field of cosmochemistry is to understand that. That's why return missions like the Hayabusa, the Japanese mission, and the OSIRIS-REx mission that NASA just completed are so important, because we can get to study samples that have not been contaminated by their falling on Earth. We can look at them under their pristine state and try to reveal what they contain.
Well, if they're on asteroids and if they're on parts of meteorites, where were they formed in the first place and how come?
Yes, so the way we think about it is every planetary system starts as a giant cloud. There is mostly gas in it and maybe 1% of small dust, and it's very cold. But eventually it becomes gravitationally unstable, collapses onto itself, the center of it will form the star, and the rest of the material will be spread, and because of angular momentum conservation, it will become a disk. All of this is very turbulent. There's a lot of heat that gets generated from it. And in the case of our solar system, actually, there was also some radioactive elements like aluminum-26, which decay rapidly and create even more heat. So once you start to accumulate dust into grains and grains into bigger bodies, they can heat up to hundreds of degrees, sometimes thousands of degrees, and then they melt and they differentiate a core and a mantle, just like the Earth. Sometimes they only heat up to a few hundred degrees, and that's where a lot of chemistry can happen. You have water, you have some small organic molecules that are precursors, and it's an open field. We don't really know what can happen.
Carbon, of course, with its four links, is able to hold hands with lots of things and indeed form a benzene ring from which more stuff can accumulate, and so complexity can be produced like that. Is that the idea?
It is, for sure. The exact pathways are actually subject of investigation today. We have theoretical ideas, things that have been proposed, but to really pinpoint and do actual tracing of what was happening, you need tools that will allow us to say this particular carbon came from this particular molecule and then went into this particular site. And then you can see how the organic chemistry functions.
But in the middle of your huge blackboard, I can see PB, lead. Mm-hmm. Now, going to a different sort of heating, very hot around here, the fires of Los Angeles. What took you to the remnants of those fires where whole buildings, homes had been burnt down to analyze what was there? What did you look for?
Yeah, so last year in January 2025, Los Angeles has been impacted by two gigantic fires. You could call them urban firestorms because of the way the system self-propagates. And one of the very concerning observations that came early on was one of my colleagues told me they have a system a few miles away, south of the fire zone, that measures not only the amount of dust in the air, but also the chemical composition of that dust. And he said within a couple of days, we are seeing a lot of lead in the air.
Now, I could understand that in ancient Rome, because their plumbing was made. You can handle lead and make it into tubes and baths, and it's fairly soft. But Los Angeles in the 21st century?
Absolutely. Before the fire, there was no detectable lead, or if it is detectable, it's just because the instrument is so sensitive, but the actual amount of lead is so small. During the fire, we went back to 1980s level of lead in the air, not as high as during the full leaded gasoline era, but 10% of the way there, which is many times above what we typically have here.
From paint?
The good question. If you ask the insurance companies, they'll say that it's legacy lead. That's what they call lead that has been deposited in the environment by leaded gasoline. But that actually doesn't add up. If you look at the age of the houses that were burned just north of Caltech, 90% of the houses were built before the 70s. That's when lead was banned. And so all of these houses had lead paint, very likely, also very likely lead pipes. And then there's also lead in car batteries still today because they're lead-based. So with 10,000 plus structures burnt and many thousands of cars burnt, there's a lot of lead being released.
And isn't it quaint in many ways? You go to a petrol station and one of the petrols you can get is called unleaded. You know, going way back, still saying unleaded. Can you still get leaded petrol, or, you know, what's going on?
So leaded gasoline has been banned in the US in 1996, full ban. The last country in the world was Algeria in 2021, which is still very recent. The only use for leaded gasoline that remains is small planes. Like if you have a pilot license and you fly one of those small planes, those still work with leaded gasoline. Everything else has been banned and removed. So cars definitely don't work with leaded gasoline anymore.
Yeah. It used to be in petrol to stop it knocking. What was knocking?
Knocking is when the engine makes a lot of noise because burning is uneven, and then that often resulted in stalling of the engine. So the oil industry and the gasoline industry tried to find a compound that would prevent knocking. They tried a few things, leaded gasoline, so tetraethyl lead was the best compound they could find, with the problem that it's poisoning the environment and humans and leading to lifelong damages to the body, cognitive development issues and impairments, kidney, cardiovascular issues, skeleton.
Which is just so unfortunate because they used to make lead toys for children.
Oh yeah, at the very same time they were doing leaded gasoline, you can still buy in the 1920s, 1940s, you can buy paint books that say proudly on the top of the page, front page, all lead paint. Well, thankfully, this has gone away with regulations and proper realization of the health issue this represents.
After the fires, was the lead in the air of such a level as to be harmful?
So during the fire, during the 3 days of the fire, we observed pretty high lead levels, but this was very transient. Unless you were breathing fumes 24/7 for those 3 days, in which case the exposure was certainly high. The general population is unlikely to have been very affected by the lead. The problem is it went away from the air because it got deposited in dust, in the environment, and more importantly, in standing homes. So all of the homes that burnt, the ashes contain lead. This is a problem, but most of the debris have been removed. So the lots that have burned have been cleared in some way. But if your house has not burned and was in the burn zone or was in the fire plume, then it very likely contains lead. At least the data that we have acquired shows that they contain lead in pretty high levels.
Do you think it might be the case in Australia with all its fires as well?
That's a very good question. You're starting to touch on to the nuance between what we would call a wildfire and an urban fire. And so it really depends on what is being burned. Trees, plants, they're like us. They don't like to uptake lead. You can burn a lot of wood. It is not going to be a big heavy metal release mechanism. But if you burn houses from 1930, that's a different question.
When you were working on space chemistry, did you expect to have that sudden switch, or was it a sudden switch? How do you put the two elements of your studies together?
Yeah, the thing I like about my work is we have one type of instrument, mass spectrometers, and they're very versatile. We can study almost any question we want that has to do with transfer of mass between reservoirs. So you can think of meteorites going across the solar system. You can think of oceans mixing, or even things happening in the human body. And here, the lead being summoned and released from the fire and then transported and deposited into standing homes, we can study it as well.
And the message actually in the science show and coming to a place like Caltech is how versatile a particular study is. You're not diminishing it by being broad, but you're making it more flexible so that you can, just like geologists, can work in space science and looking at fossils and all sorts of things like that. And you can do stuff at homes and stuff in space. Is that a characteristic of Caltech?
I would definitely say it is a characteristic of Caltech. What we are being asked to do as Caltech professors is go where the highest impact can be for the skills we have developed, and the questions that interest us usually lead to the highest impact. In this particular case, one of my colleagues said, oh, there's lead in the air. We immediately started looking for literature data on, okay, what happens to lead when it's being burnt in a home and released, and there is just no data. And so when there is no data to make a proper risk assessment or something like this, you have to go and measure samples and produce the data that will allow people to safely return to their home or create new regulations because it turns out we have a new type of threat associated with fires.
By the way, who is the person who turned the lead story around by warning people about putting lead in petrol?
Oh, Caltech has this very strong affiliation in the lead contamination world, where in the 1950s, Claire Patterson, he was a graduate student at the University of Chicago, where he tried to develop uranium lead dating to get to the age of the Earth. What Patterson was trying to do was measure very small amounts of lead contained in a mineral called zircon, and turned out that every time he was doing the measurement, there was too much lead. There was too much lead, the rock came back too old. He was using a rock whose age was already known as a benchmark, and that led him to realize that there was lead at every point of his process. There was lead in the labware, there was lead on the dust in the lab, there was lead in the water, because the water came from leaded pipes. And so when he came to Caltech after his PhD with his advisor, who was hired to create the geochemistry option here in the division, the first thing he did is that he built the first clean lab in the world. They took a room, they removed everything that was leaded, the paint, the pipes, everything. And then he developed protocols to leach the lead away from everything he was using. So he would dunk everything in acids. He would wrap his body in plastic bags that had been dunked in acid. And once he had removed all the lead from that one space, he could bring samples in there and measure them. And as he was doing that, he realized that there had to be a massive source of lead, not volcanic eruptions, not just regular geological cycle, something, a spike of lead being released in the environment. And the only reasonable source was leaded gasoline, which when he first wrote a paper arguing for that, was not a pleasant news for the lead industry. And they tried to offer him a lot of funding to study something else, which he declined. So then they got his funding rescinded. He was actually funded by the American Petroleum Institute at the time. It's a fantastic story. And the next 30 years of his life, so this is 1965, he publishes the first paper saying, there is lead in the environment. It is from leaded gasoline. Just remove it. The industry is very upset. There is a Senate hearing for the Clean Air Act where they interview the lead industry experts. They also interviewed Patterson, and Patterson just shredded all of the argumentation of the industry, showing very clearly that it was the lead gasoline that was responsible for that poisoning. The problem is that he was the only one able to make the measurements because he was the only one with a lab clean enough to make the measurements. Everyone else, even the lead industry, they would measure the lead in the blood of someone who is working in the factory handling the tetraethyl lead. They would measure the lead in the blood of someone working in an office further away. They would get the same value, and they would conclude it is the normal level of lead in the human body. And Patterson did not believe that was the case. So he went and he measured lead in the teeth of 2,000-year-old mummies. And he showed there was 1,000 times less than in the modern American.
Even in Rome.
Rome was already contaminated. But if you looked at Peruvian mummies from 2,000, 4,000 years ago, they had 1,000 times less lead than the average American. And so his work was instrumental because he demonstrated that the normal level of lead in the human body is zero. There should be no lead. And the average American was 500 times, 1,000 times enriched above background, and that value was so high that it was only a factor of 4 away from lead poisoning.
Professor François Tissot on why you and I buy unleaded fuel. And as with asbestos, how the industry fought the scientific evidence to the very end. By the way, do you recall the stats of those poorer folk living alongside motorways way back in cheap houses where the lead emissions were greatest? They were said to have IQs below the other averages. So let's clear the air now with a ride in a Waymo, a driverless taxi you can find in big towns such as LA and Phoenix. Australian publisher Kylie O'Hearn is my host. Kylie O'Hearn, where are we now?
We're in a Waymo in Phoenix, Arizona.
A Waymo being what? Looks like a car to me.
A driverless car that came out of Google, X the Moonshot Factory.
As it drove up, I saw it had something like a little lighthouse on top. What's that?
I guess it's just its way of saying hi. It had my initial KA on it, so I knew it was mine.
And that sort of mournful music is
you can change
to calm you down so that you don't think this is going to be a terrifying experience. Is that right? And someone next to me, you're from Harvard, are you?
Close. I'm actually from the California Institute of Technology, which is Caltech. And it is a management of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is funded through the American taxpayer.
And if you're from Caltech, you obviously got a Nobel Prize. What's that in?
Well, what we like to refer to as, you know, rehearsing the future. Like, how are we going to do that? What are the different multiple narratives that we're going to go forward in? Which one are we going to choose? And are we going to choose, you know, desperation and bankruptcy or
exasperation? The first person I met from Caltech was, in fact, Linus Pauling, who had 2 Nobel Prizes, one in chemistry in the chemical bond, and one in peace.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And he didn't have to ask for it like some people, but still, I am looking out at the landscape, it's a very nice landscape. Mm. Not too many cars to bump into. Kylie, how many times have you done this in a Waymo?
This is my 97th trip. I mean, I love Waymo. It's the promise the Jetsons made all those years ago.
Are they expensive? Can you just hire them by phone and go where you like?
So you download an app and it's like a getting an Uber. So it's probably more along the price of Uber Comfort, not the baseline Uber.
And there was a nice tight corner there that we turned, with confidence, obviously. And you don't get sort of thrill up your back and elsewhere as this happens? Are you relaxed about it?
I'm totally relaxed. I find them to be more a conservative driver, but not too conservative so that it's slow. And I've been in a few traffic jams with them and they've managed to navigate around. But look, as a woman, I feel a lot safer at night. The taxis are really clean. I can put my own music on. I can listen to an audio book. It's exciting and fun.
What instructions were there about destination?
So I just put in, like I would with Uber, the destination. We're doing a round trip, so I've added a stop. I haven't done that before where I've stayed in the car for a stop. And then, yeah, you have to wait a few minutes. And then when it arrives, through the app, you just unlock it.
How many years have we had them, or are they brand new around America?
It's been a few years, I think. So in 2024, I think that was the first time. So when I was in America in San Francisco in 2024 in February, I applied through the app. They approved me a couple of weeks later and then I could use it. And then I think it was early 2025 or sometime last year, it became taxi that you just needed an app and anyone could use. And it's here in Phoenix, it's in San Francisco, LA, and I think it's somewhere, maybe it's somewhere in, what's that other place in Texas that's not Houston?
Austin.
I think it's in Austin. I don't know. I feel like a spokesperson right now.
Well, Austin is very good because it has number plates saying proud to be weird. And so it would
Austin.
Fit there.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. And have you had them at Caltech at all?
Well, I've been noticing more and more Waymos on the west side of LA. And over the last year, they've just proliferated like pinto beans, you know, on a hot day.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I hope that'll reduce the overall traffic because sometimes in LA it's horrendous.
Yeah, the traffic in LA is kind of unbearable for the most part. You know, public transportation in Los Angeles has gotten much better. We've gotten millions of dollars put into the infrastructure on rail lines. You know, they still don't have one that goes directly to the airport, which I think one of the only cities in the whole world that doesn't have a major link to an airport. Yeah.
By the way, without being dark, I was supposed to go to JPL, in other words, the Jet Propulsion Lab next to Caltech, but they require a form because obviously there's a lot of security and all that sort of thing. And I said to the people who are going to be my host, like, I always fail a form. You know, online, I always get something wrong, and on this occasion, even though I tried about four times, I got my phone number wrong in the sense that it would not accept my real phone number. It's the only one I've got. And, you know, plus 61 for Australia and all that sort of thing. Nah. And so it was cancelled.
No, I've had that before, too. I actually, I do a fair amount of work going back and forth between the campus up at JPL and the Caltech campus, and I had not renewed my driver's license. And so, you know, I had a big meeting up there, and I got up to the front desk, and like, oh, you can't come in. You haven't renewed your... Okay, I guess I'll zoom in here for this one, you know.
But, amazing, yeah. Kylie, what do you have to do to qualify to be a passenger?
Oh, nothing now. I mean, I think you have to be interested in technology and just wanting to give it a go. But actually, I've come up with a new radio series for you, Robin, which is Riding in Waymo with Robin.
Kylie, can I ask a question? Yeah. Do you trust computer-driven cars more than humans?
Yes. I have been in a cab in LA, and I can absolutely guarantee you, I think there's less error in robotic cars than human-driven cars.
Me in a Waymo, an adapted Jaguar, actually, driverless taxi. Clean, smooth, and clearly safe. Kylie, by the way, was once with the journal Nature, but before that was one of the editors and publishers of our late departed and very much missed Australian science magazine Cosmos. Do you perhaps miss that other Cosmos from long ago? Here's a clue.
Another aspect of this question is the exploration of our solar system by unmanned spacecraft. That's important, for example, for finding out if there are simple forms of life on, say, Mars or Jupiter. If the answer to that were yes, then the likelihood of the origin of life on planets of other stars would, of course, be vastly greater. Imagine a program of unmanned exploration of the entire solar system for the decade of the 1970s, which would examine every planet in the solar system, which would land several space vehicles on the surface of Mars. What would such a program cost? Such a program would cost less than the 1970 fiscal year cost overrun on the anti-ballistic missile system. To put that in another way, the accounting errors in the Department of Defense on a single weapon system come to more than a decade's exploration of the entire solar system. So again, it strikes me that this nation has the resources to undertake such exploratory ventures, and certainly this planet has those resources. It's just a question of, do we wish to do it?
Carl Sagan, original host of the Cosmos TV series, pioneering space broadcasting. Sagan himself did fine work on Venus, the planet, as well as advocacy for major research. He was an inspiration for many of us, and one young spirit then was Eric Pitagura, now Professor of Physics and Astronomy at UCLA.
Yeah, so I don't know exactly why, but my parents rented the original Cosmos TV series on a Laserdisc, so that kind of dates it a little bit. And so I remember putting in these dinner plate-sized things into our Laserdisc player and watching these things, and I was probably about five. And you know, I actually just had the opportunity to watch these TV shows again with my five-year-old. And you don't understand everything in there, but there was something about it that was just captivating. And so I watched the shows so many times. We ripped them off the Laserdisc onto VHS. And that was kind of my entertainment growing up. And so I got really hooked in science. That show was very wide-ranging. You know, it was focused on astronomy and the universe, but also life and philosophy and humanity, religion. It sort of covered everything. And from then on, I just wanted to be a scientist and wanted to be an astronomer. And so here I am. I'm 37 now. And
a professor.
Yes. Well, they'll still have me. And I get to do this every day. So it's really a dream come true.
When we look at our own galaxy, it seems reasonably straightforward. You've got very, very big planets. And you've got small ones, you've got Neptunes and you've got Mercuries. Are there really supposed to be, according to some of your research, ones in between that are missing?
Yeah, absolutely. Going back to Carl, there's this scene I remember from one of the episodes where he's got this cartoon diagram of the solar system and you've got the small planets close in and then you've got the big planets farther out. And there was sort of this like nice just-so story of why that was the case, right? It's too hot for the gas to stick to the planets when they're too close. And so, of course, we have the small planets close in. And, of course, they're the size of Earth and Mercury, right? It just, that makes sense. And then I remember he turned the page and there were all of these other hypothetical systems. And he said, well, what if there's a giant planet close in? What if one of those giant planets got so much gas that it ignited and started fusing hydrogen into helium and became a star? Could we have systems where everything's all jumbled up? And at the time, the show was produced in the 80s, I think around 1980. All of this was just speculation. And what's remarkable now is that we know nature is so diverse and there's all sorts of mixed up planetary systems, systems where giant planets are close in, ones where they're extremely compact, very close to their host stars, and some like our own solar system. And so I think we know that our solar system is only just one outcome of something that's very diverse.
Are there any in-between ones that have a shape and a constitution that is predictable? In other words, are they all on a pattern? Yeah. Or are they all infinitely varied?
Yeah, so when you learn about the solar system, you know, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, depending on your age, Pluto, there's basically three types of planets in our own solar system. There's what we call the terrestrial planets. So these are rocky, basically the size of the Earth and smaller. Venus is about the same size as the Earth. Mars and Mercury are a little smaller. Then you have the gas giants, Jupiter and Saturn. Those are about 10 times the size of the Earth, and they are 100 Earth masses or more. So much bigger, much more massive. And then you have Uranus and Neptune, which are about 4 times the size of the Earth. And that's basically it. There's like those three types of planets. So we have 8 planets in our solar system and 3 types. And the most common type of planet there is a planet between the size of Earth and Neptune. And no one really predicted this. So, you know, these are the most common types of planets out there. And thanks to missions like Kepler, we know a lot about what they're made out of. We know how their orbits are arranged. And we know a lot about how they formed.
Where are some of the nearest ones of that pattern?
There are planets like that around some of the nearest stars to the sun. And so those planets occur at a rate of about 1 per star. So chances are if you go out and you just point at a random star, they will have one of those in-between planets around them.
And how are you following them up and studying them?
So there's a couple different ways in which you can find a planet like that. One of the easiest ways is to have a telescope in space that measures the brightness of stars. And if a planet happens to transit in front of that star, cross in front of the star, you'll get a little bit of dimming, and that dimming will tell you the size of the planet. Now, you have to have that planet happen to transit in front of the star. And so that requires the orbit to be very edge-on. And so we can't find all of those types of planets that way, but it's a way in which we can find a lot of them because there's billions of stars in the Milky Way galaxy. There are other ways in which you can find planets like that. For example, we can use something called the Doppler technique, which measures the wobble of a star. And that can find planets even if they don't happen to transit in front of them. And so there's multiple ways of finding these types of planets.
And what is your quest, to find them and study them individually deeply, or to accumulate numbers so that you've got lots?
Why not both? So that's what we do. So there are some things that you learn by collecting big samples of things. So for example, if you want to know what the average person thinks, right, broadly, you go off, you survey 1,000 people, and you ask them some fairly generic questions, you know, who you're going to vote for, that kind of thing. But if you want to understand why someone thinks a certain way, like you have to bring them into a focus group and ask them more detailed questions. And that's kind of the same strategy that my group and others do to learn about planets and how they form. And so one example of a study where we really needed the numbers was to figure out how these small planets are really divided into 2 different types. So when these intermediate-sized planets were first being found, people were throwing around several candidate names. You know, I heard sub-Neptunes because they were smaller than Neptunes, or if you really wanted to get some media attention, you would say a super-Earth, right? And people were saying these things without really much justification, right? These planets that were bigger than the Earth, they had no idea if they were scaled-up versions of the Earth or not. And so these terms stuck around, and they were basically a matter of convenience. But over a period of several years, I was involved with a big project where we went off and we precisely measured the sizes of about 2,000 planets. And in proving how well we knew the sizes, we basically saw that there were 2 populations of planets. So if you have some error in how well you can measure the size, what that does is it sort of blurs out the features in the population. But when you have very precise measurements, we basically saw this parting of the Red Seas, and this what looked like one population split into 2. And now it's like, oh, we have 2 different types of planets. And as it turns out, the smaller ones are indeed rocky, and the larger ones have a thick gaseous envelope around them. And so now we can actually, with some certainty and justification, call 1 class of planets super-Earths because they're big rocky planets, scaled up versions of the Earth, and the other class of planets sub-Neptunes because sort of scaled down versions of Neptune with gaseous envelopes.
Let me ask you a question about each of those. Now, imagine you've got a super-Earth. It's by definition bigger than the Earth, and let's say it's somewhere here in our galaxy, and you land on it. I presume gravity would be much more intense. And so people running around or creatures running around would be unlikely.
That may not be the most problematic aspect of a lot of these planets. So remember I was telling you the way in which we find a lot of these planets is with the transit method. And the probability that a planet just happens to go in front of its host star goes down the farther away from the star you are. You need a much more sort of particular alignment. And so it just so happens that because of the biases of this detection technique, many of these planets are close in. So a lot of them are really hot. So a lot of the super Earths we know about are the temperature of Venus. So that may be more of a problem for life on this planet than the gravity. If you want to talk about the gravity, it'd be a little bit more than the Earth. It wouldn't be that much. And humans can walk on the moon if they have the right breathing equipment. The low gravity of the moon is no problem for life. And a planet with twice the gravity of the Earth would not be a problem.
Now, when it comes to the bigger ones, the Neptunes and the Jupiters, I've often wondered, with all that gas going fast distances, is there in the middle a great big lump?
Oh, in the
solid, yeah.
In the center of these planets? Absolutely. So Jupiter, for example, we know has a rocky core in the center. And we know that that core is 10 to 20 Earth masses. One of the ways in which we know that is we orbit spacecraft around Jupiter, and you can make very detailed measurements about how that spacecraft orbits. And that tells you about the gravity of Jupiter, which tells you about the extent of the mass concentration. And one really interesting recent result actually is that Jupiter is known to have a core that's slightly diffuse. So something about how Jupiter formed either made this fuzzy core or eroded away this sharp boundary of this core. So anyway, the giant planets have high density material in the center, probably rock and iron, just like the Earth.
What's your next step in studying these amazing intermediate planets? What you can do next?
Yeah, so one of the things that's really interesting is to study these planets as a function of time, seeing how they evolve. What we would love is to be able to make a movie of how planets form, you know, starting from the collapse of a molecular cloud, the accretion of gas, and subsequent evolution. We'd love to make a movie of this, but this unfortunately takes billions of years. And so one of the great things about astronomy is that there are so many examples of various objects out in the universe that if we can assign an age to a particular one, then we can go and say, oh, that one's a million years old, that one's 100 million years old, that one's a billion years old. And so by studying objects as a function of their age, we can figure out how things evolve. We can basically make that movie. And so I'm really interested in how planetary systems evolve with time. And we're sort of taking a pretty clear step toward this with a system of small planets that I and some collaborators published a few months ago called V1298 Tau. It's a 20 million year old planetary system. It's basically like a baby planetary system. Like I think it's equivalent to like a 2 month old infant in human years. And this is basically a precursor to the most common types of planets we see in the galaxy.
Professor Eric Pettigura at the University of California, Los Angeles, which has a close relationship with Caltech, the science show on Radio National. I mentioned in the beginning that scientists at Caltech often have a delicious range of experience and skills, and none more so than a young woman from Oxford who studied maths and finance and now, would you believe, runs the Keck Centre for Space Research. Meet Harriet Brettel.
I like to say that I took the scenic route. I've always followed what I was passionate about. When I was younger, maths was a foundation that meant that you could do so many different things, and that really appealed to me. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and I found myself working in finance before I rediscovered my passion for space and space science. And so it was going back to school, studying astrophysics, moving across the world to study planets here at Caltech that really brought me a very rewarding and varied career, and all of those different pieces have kind of been the building blocks of a career that's got me here to the Keck Institute.
Well, one of the reasons I ask is the fact that Caltech's pretty hard to get into. It's a small campus, but it's got so many Nobel Prize winners, it's almost embarrassing. And you got in to study one of their strongest points, which is astronomy and maths.
Yeah, I feel incredibly lucky. So I was applying for grad school. And one of the nice things about studying in the US is there's a little bit more flexibility in terms of the topic that you come to study. And at the time, I was working in finance, but really was interested in exoplanets and planetary science. And initially, I wasn't going to apply to Caltech because, like you said, I thought there's no way I'm going to get in. But I applied on a dime and put my application in. And what I was talking about, particularly in my application, was the relevant background that I had in statistics and data analysis that is actually relevant from my finance background and could be applied to astronomy and planetary science. And so a lot of the same statistical models that are used in the financial industry are also used to help to detect and characterize exoplanets. And so it was the intersection of those different areas that I was looking to develop more of my skill set in.
There are so many stories around that. For instance, one of my heroes, an Australian, known as the Professor of Everything, Bob May, actually became the chief scientist in Britain. And he worked with the head of the bank, the top economist, because, as you said, some of the maths was more or less the same. And when you wanted a positive result, said this ex-physicist, putting the ideas together. So what are you in charge of? How does it work?
That's a great question. So now I'm the exec director of the Keck Institute for Space Studies. So we are a think and do tank that's based here at Caltech. And we work very closely with our colleagues at the Jet Propulsion Lab. Our mission is really to bring together scientists and engineers to develop concepts that can revolutionize the future of space exploration. And so we do that by selecting a number of key topics across planetary science, astronomy, earth science and engineering that will help to bring together those ideas, the right experts from Caltech, from JPL, from abroad, from all different perspectives to come together and really try and make progress on a particularly challenging problem. We do that by organizing workshops throughout the year. It's a tremendously dynamic and exciting place to be. And I really enjoy being able to look across all of these different topics in space science and help to bring together those experts that can make meaningful progress in those areas.
So you've got to recognize what sounds like a good field to do research. If you're, say, in San Diego, and someone, an astronomer, said, well, I'd like to measure the constitution of the atmosphere and go to the top of Hawaii and CO2, let's see how much CO2 there is. Mm-hmm. And that experiment changed the world in many ways. Do you have to recognize what seems unlikely like that to see whether it's got legs?
Yeah, you raise an interesting challenge that we have in terms of the topics that we select. So we have a committee of experts from Caltech professors and leaders at JPL who help us to review the ideas that are submitted to our institute to see what's a good fit for what we want to do. We're not looking for problems that are easy to solve or are incremental in nature. We're really looking for those topics that can be high risk, that you don't necessarily know what the answer is going to be, but you want to bring together the right group of experts to help to solve that challenge. And so it's really about that balance of being crazy enough that it's worth coming together and trying to solve that challenge, but maybe not too crazy that it's completely impossible.
And what crazy ideas have you got working now to come up soon?
And so we've got a number of exciting topics that we've got coming up very soon. Actually, our next workshop is going to be bringing together experts around the concept of hybrid space ground observatories. So the idea here is that historically in the study of astronomy, you have two places you can build your telescope. You can build a telescope on the ground in Hawaii, maybe, as you suggested, or you can have a space-based telescope. Right? And both have pros and cons and different trade-offs. The purpose of the study, where we're going to be bringing together experts from many different domains, is to try and combine those two things. So you have what we call a star shade in space orbiting the Earth, and combining that with a giant ground-based telescope here on Earth, that means you can get some of the benefits of both of those infrastructures and do astronomy that hasn't been possible before.
We'd actually did a program a couple of weeks ago in the Science Show where I reminded people of something that was going on in physics in northern Sydney. And they were actually looking for little black holes because they thought they might be floating around the place. They didn't find any. But then they looked at the apparatus and someone said, this could be used for Wi-Fi. That's how Wi-Fi came to be.
And that's one of the things that often happens with science. You know, you're asking one question and maybe you don't get an answer in that domain, but you open up opportunities somewhere else. And that's what I find really exciting about the workshops that we do. We're bringing together amazing experts from different fields. And sometimes it's about the new questions that you find that you're asking throughout the journey that leads you to places you didn't necessarily expect when you start the project.
When I was here last year, mm-hmm. and I was quite close to the JPL, that was the day they had been told how much they'd been cut by Washington, D.C. How are they doing at the moment?
One thing that has been positive that's taken place in the last few weeks, I would say, is that NASA now has a confirmed budget for the next financial year. And so last year, there were real concerns that the NASA budget was going to be cut very drastically. The latest budget that has been passed and approved actually restores the budget for space science to what it was in previous years. And so hopefully that means that the incredibly important and cutting-edge science that can be done across NASA, but including at JPL, can continue and thrive.
And we have Congress to thank, because what they were required to do by the president, they said no.
And I think the other thing that is important to maybe mention is the advocacy of the general public and organizations like the Planetary Society that really advocated for demonstrating the importance of space science to the wider public and the community.
You used to be at the European outfit, which of course has combined very well, sharing expenses for some pretty amazing explorations. Mm-hmm. They also had a fairly rough trot at some things. How are they doing now with various experiments?
Before I was here, I was working at the European Space Agency, and they've had a very exciting development in recent months as well. Every 3 years, the countries that make up the membership of the European Space Agency meet together to commit on the funding of the agency going forward across a number of different domains. And they had a very successful, what's called the ministerial event last November, and that secured record funding for the European Space Agency, but also record levels of funding for their science directorate as well. So very excited to see what missions they'll be able to develop for that in the future.
Could you tell me whether you've ever been to the Keck telescope itself? I know it's separate, but have you been there?
You know what? I was very lucky to go there when I was a grad student here at Caltech. So one of the research projects I was involved in was working with a professor here, Mike Brown, and we were looking at the variability of the exosphere of Europa, one of Jupiter's moons. And I remember when Mike was telling me about this project, and the idea was to do repeated observations of Europa using the Keck telescope in Hawaii. And that meant observing for a short amount of time, but over multiple nights. And I was really excited about this project because it meant a lot of telescope time, and that's an incredible opportunity, particularly as a grad student. Until I learned that there was a remote operating facility here on campus that meant I didn't need to go to Hawaii every time we were going to be doing those observations. But having said that, I was very fortunate that I had the opportunity to go and do the observing one time from the base of Mauna Kea, and it was an incredible experience.
So you could actually use the telescope to look at something?
Yes, absolutely.
Normally, it's these days, it's just a bunch of numbers.
Yes, so we were using the Keck telescope to look at Europa and to try and detect how much sodium there was in the exosphere, so the very, very thin atmosphere that you have around the surface of the moon, and seeing how that changed over time and what that might mean for the implications of the surface of the moon.
What are you going to do next?
Oh, well, I have to say I'm incredibly happy here. One of the wonderful things about the Keck Institute is we're always looking for new ideas, new research topics, and there's always more to explore when it comes to space. So I think I have found the perfect place to continue to grow, learn, and hopefully do my part to help shape the future of space exploration.
And as you say, hopefully perhaps coming back to Australia again and look at our astronomers.
I would love that. Yes, please.
Harriet Brettel running the Keck Centre for Space Research. And finally, a tale from the telescope pioneer we heard last week, Professor Jonas Mizdemas, talking about Australia and another impressive connection.
Well, once I fell into astrophysics, I never got out of the rut and ended up as a postdoc at Illinois, then came here to Caltech 36 years ago. And I've been basically working in the same field ever since, this astronomy at these wavelengths, and you could say wavelengths shorter than a millimeter, the submillimeter and the far infrared. And for a physicist, it's been a lot of fun because The technology when I started was extremely primitive. Building instruments, building detectors was very difficult. A lot of development, a lot of invention was needed. And that's basically been my career, figuring out how to do astronomy at these wavelengths with ever-increasing sensitivity and power. And we're reaching the fundamental limits now with a project like PRIMA.
Excellent. Did you happen to come across John Bolton, who actually worked in radar in Sydney when he helped invent radio telescope work with Ruby Payne Scott and a couple of others? Very few people know that the origins of radio astronomy were actually like that, in that place, using Sydney Harbour as a second source.
I unfortunately never got to know Bolton. I certainly have read about him. He's famous here at Caltech for starting our radio astronomy program. And if you study radio astronomy in any depth, you will absolutely learn about Bolton's C interferometer. And I've looked up his paper and I've read it myself a number of times. It's a shame I never got a chance to meet him. That would have been fabulous. But I see everything that you could say flowed from his work, the development of the Owens Valley Radio Observatory about 5 hours from here, which continues today to be extremely productive, all to Bolton's credit.
And of course, he spectacularly resigned from here to go back to a sheep's paddock near Parkes, New South Wales. The Parkes Radio Telescope, which brought you so many pulsars and some people say the beginnings of the walk on the moon, although that was another instrument which took over. But Bolton was a really fascinating character, and it's good to know that there's been such a relationship between Caltech astronomy and even Australia.
Well, Bolton certainly made a big impact, not just here at Caltech, but in the United States generally, and in the development of radio astronomy in the United States. He certainly deserves a lot of credit for what he did. And I'd say that observing the success of Parkes over the years and all the fabulous discoveries that have flowed from there, and even quite recently, the discovery of these so-called fast radio bursts. I forget when that was, maybe two decades ago by now, but that's created an entirely new field of astrophysics. It's all coming from Bolton.
They gave him a different name in the film, The Dish. Do you remember who played him?
That's a difficult question.
It was Sam Neill, and there he was, being in charge. And I think it's also a bit of a legend that they played cricket on The Dish. I don't think they did.
No, that would be probably an interesting thing to watch.
I wish you luck with the project, and I hope it comes off.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated.
Professor of Physics at Caltech, Dr. Jonas Zmitsamas, confirming once more how Australian brilliance pioneered the field of radio astronomy. And another reminder while I'm at it, the first person to publish her discovery of a black hole in space was Louise Webster in the journal Nature in 1972. The very first. Louise was from the University of New South Wales. Next week, Bell, another amazing story, how a professor at Caltech, of course, is making new life forms direct from DNA with the help of AI. And from you next week?
Well, along the lines of creating life from DNA, I'm looking into how 10% of our genome is made up of DNA that was shoved in there by viruses. I'm talking your genome, Robin, mine, everyone listening. How did all this viral genetic material end up in ours? And what effect do these strings of DNA have on us today? And next week, I'll have a story about this. Now, it's not just for rev heads, it's for people interested in sustainable fuels as well. And with the Melbourne Grand Prix kicking off the F1 season, I'll be joined by the ABC's Darren Osborne science cadet, Amy Briggs, for a chat about why Formula One cars might sound a bit different this year, and if F1's sustainable fuel, which all the cars have to use, is truly sustainable. The Science Show is produced by Patria Ladgrove. I'm Belinda Smith. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.